Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy's recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
Ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Monday, the 10th of July, these are our main stories. President Biden has said the current Israeli government has some of the most extreme members he's ever seen. His comments come days after Israel launched a deadly operation in the West Bank. The BBC's confirmed that a male presenter has been suspended while it investigates allegations that he paid a teenager for sexually explicit photos. The Colombian government is set to resume talks with a faction of the former FARC rebel group that refused to sign up to a peace deal in 2016. Also in this podcast.
If I say from 1 to 10 scale, then it's about million times excited. I'm purposely here on a holiday to get this book.
A memoir by the K-pop band BTS is causing a stir among its fans. We start with President Biden, who has blamed what he described as some of the most extreme members of Israel's government for being what he called part of the problem in the occupied West Bank. He made the remark about some members of Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet during an interview with CNN. It comes less than a week after Israel launched its biggest operation in the territory for many years, killing 12 Palestinians. The US president said he also believes there are extreme elements on the Palestinian side and accused the Palestinian Authority of having lost credibility. So, are these comments surprising? A question I put to our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
It's surprising to come from any American president to have quite, you know, a frank, candid assessment of the current Israeli government that sounds as critical as this. I mean, as everyone knows, the US has been the strongest ally and friend, supporter financially, politically, for decades. So whenever a US president steps out and says something that is clearly critical of the current Israeli government, that is going to make news. I mean, I think it's important to stress that the way that it was phrased by Joe Biden, and as we know, I mean, the way that he speaks isn't always entirely crystal clear, but he is not saying, I think, the whole government, so that's Benjamin Netanyahu, etc., is the most extremist Israeli government that he's ever experienced in his long, long career. What he's saying is that it has some of the most extremist members within the cabinet. And I mean, that is just a fact acknowledged in Israel. I mean, what he essentially is saying within the segment about Israel is that there are extremists amongst the Palestinians, and now essentially there are some extremists amongst Israel.
Well, I was going to get on to that, actually, because it clearly, to use a simplistic phrase, it sounds like he's trying to knock heads together to an extent, because he did use a similar phrasing to describe what he called extreme elements on the Palestinian side as well.
Yes, and that is kind of normal for a US president to do. It's also, I mean, not exactly knock heads together and not to give that kind of equivalence, perhaps. But again, as I say, he's giving an equivalence of the extreme. So he's acknowledging there's an extreme within the Israeli government, but not defining the Israeli government or defining Israel. And to some extent, he's doing the same thing about the Palestinians. There are extremists within them, but he's not saying that the Palestinian Authority is extreme in itself. So we had the years of President Trump, and it was far less even-handed. And what we've seen in President Biden is a return to the status quo, in that rhetorically, at least, the president is trying to seem as fair to both sides as possible and to acknowledge the problems on both sides.
Sebastian Usher, and while we digest those comments on Israel, President Biden has arrived in the UK, where he's due to meet Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak at Downing Street later. The two leaders have taken different stances on the US decision to supply cluster bombs to Ukraine, with the UK a signatory to a convention against their use. Mr. Biden and Mr. Sunak will attend a NATO summit in Lithuania on Tuesday. The international relations specialist, Dr. Leslie Vindjamuri from Chatham House, says it could be a difficult meeting in Vilnius.
We're thinking here about Sweden's membership bid to be a full member of NATO, which Turkey has held up. And there's a very significant question about what terms and conditions will be agreed for the prospect of Ukraine's membership in NATO. Very difficult issues, not the only ones.
For more details, here's the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason.
This will be the fifth meeting between the President and the Prime Minister in 5 months, but it will be a fleeting visit. The President is expected in Downing Street this morning for talks with Rishi Sunak. The backdrop is one of public difference over Washington's decision to supply what are known as cluster bombs to Ukraine. The UK is one of over 120 countries that has signed a convention banning their use because of the danger they pose to civilians. After President Biden's met Mr. Sunak, he'll head to Windsor to see the King, the environment and climate expected to feature in that conversation. This is not a state visit, but there will still be splashes of pageantry, a marching band, a guard of honour. After that, the President will leave for Lithuania.
Chris Mason. The US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says her country's relationship with China is improving. She's finished a 4-day trip to Beijing after months of tension between the two nations. Ms. Yellen described her talks with the Chinese vice premier as candid and constructive and said the world was big enough for both states to thrive. Here's our Asia correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
Janet Yellen appears to believe that she has succeeded in opening a new, more constructive relationship with China's leadership, following years in which the leaders of the world's two biggest economies have had almost no contact. Speaking to US TV network CBS, at the end of her trip to Beijing, Ms. Yellen said the lack of contact had left US-China relations in a precarious state.
My purpose is to make sure that we don't engage in a series of unintended escalatory actions that will be harmful to our economic relationship. We have had very little contact over the last several years. That's a situation where misunderstandings can develop.
Dialogue may have resumed, but big disagreements remain. The most immediate is President Biden's ban on the export to China of high-tech microchips used in the defense industry and in artificial intelligence. Ms. Yellen said she explained to her Chinese hosts the restrictions were narrowly focused and should not be interpreted as an attempt to block China's economic development. But in Beijing, that is exactly how the restrictions are being viewed.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. The Colombian government says it has reached an agreement to resume peace talks with a faction of the FARC former rebel group known as the EMC. Leonardo Rocha has more.
The EMC, or Estado Mayor Central, is believed to have as many as 3,000 fighters. They operate across Colombia and control drug trafficking in many areas. Their leader, Ivan Mordisco, didn't accept the terms of the FARC peace deal, but his group has come under frequent attack from the armed forces in recent months. Colombia's peace commissioner said the government and the rebel group would discuss a truce with the main aim of reaching a permanent cessation of hostilities. President Gustavo Petro, a former Marxist rebel himself, came to power nearly a year ago, promising to end 6 decades of conflict in Colombia.
Flash floods in northern India have claimed the lives of at least 14 people. Torrential rain triggered the flooding near Delhi. The downpour has swept away bridges and buildings, leaving residents stranded. Let's get more details from our South Asia regional editor, Ambrasan Etirajan.
Dramatic images on social media show bridges and cars being washed away in a torrent of water from the river Bias near the famous hill town of Manali in northern India. A building on the banks toppled into the fast-flowing river. Officials say a cloudburst, a heavy concentration of rains lasting for a few hours up in the mountains, could have added to the heavy monsoon downpour. Several passenger trains have been cancelled. The Indian capital of Delhi had its highest rainfall total in a single day for more than 40 years. The resulting floods have caused traffic jams and waterlogging in many areas. These local residents described how the floods have affected their areas.
The situation is very bad. It's been raining heavily for the past 12, 14 hours in Kulu and Mandi districts. And you can see that the river is overflowing. And the riverbed, which used to be so low, well, the water level has reached the roads already. Several temples have been submerged under the river water.
The conditions are very bad. I took a customer to the outskirts of Delhi and my auto rickshaw became completely submerged in water, and there were two or three other vehicles that had also become submerged. The conditions are terrible.
Schools have been shut as a precautionary measure. Residents living in ground floors of some waterlogged areas have been asked to move to safer locations. Weather forecasters have warned of more rain for the next few days.
Ambarasan Etirajan. Now, the BBC has suspended an unnamed male member of staff as it investigates allegations that a well-known presenter paid a teenager the equivalent of tens of thousands of dollars for sexually explicit photographs. The BBC said it was working as quickly as possible to establish the facts. The claims were first reported on Friday by a national newspaper here in the UK. I got more details from the BBC's Charlotte Gallagher.
The allegations are that a BBC presenter, a male presenter and a well-known name in the UK, paid a teenager £35,000, that's about $45,000, for sexually explicit photos over a period of 3 years, from when this teenager was 17 to when they were 20. The family of this teenager say they contacted the BBC in May to tell them what was happening, and they say nothing was done. Now, the BBC have said the presenter has been suspended and they've contacted police. The BBC's contacted police. The Director General, the boss of the BBC, Tim Davey, has said the BBC were made aware of allegations in May, and since that point, the BBC investigations team have been looking into those allegations. He says a separate set of accusations were revealed to the BBC on Thursday. And he's also said that the BBC are in touch with the family at the centre of this.
OK, so quite a lot to take in there, but just briefly, so BBC's looking into it. And now the police are looking into it.
Yeah, the police have confirmed they've been approached by the BBC. They've had an initial contact from the BBC. Now, there is a situation here about consent, the age of consent. So the age of sexual consent here in the UK is 16. But explicit images to make, share, possess them, if the person is under 18... that is a crime. So this person was 17 when this started.
So there are allegations involving what would appear on the face of it like some illegality. Just on the person who's being accused here, why is this person not being named?
It's two separate reasons. Firstly, defamation, which is a law to protect someone from lies, essentially, lies being made about them. And also the question of privacy, a person's reasonable right to privacy. So there are legal reasons, essentially, why this person isn't being named. But because this person isn't being named, you've had a situation where other entirely innocent BBC presenters have had to go on social media and say, it isn't me. So, for example, Gary Lineker, a lot of people will have heard of him, former footballer now, the BBC's highest paid star. Accusations were being made about him on social media and he had to come out and say, look, it's not me.
Now, the reason we're talking about this is not just because of the allegations involving what was at the time a 17-year-old and a male presenter, but also because of reputational issues here for the BBC, this organisation known all over the world. How damaging could this be for the BBC?
I think it's incredibly, incredibly damaging already, actually. If these allegations are true, it will damage trust in the BBC and will be seen as an abuse of power because you have a male presenter paying vast sums of money to a teenager.
Only if they're true, obviously.
Yeah, if they're true. For sexually explicit photos. And also the question of when these allegations were made, why wasn't this person suspended? Why were they allowed to remain on air? And that's a real question for the BBC. What kind of investigation were they carrying out? Was this presenter even aware that allegations had been made about them? There are so many questions to answer at the BBC.
Charlotte Gallagher. Still to come.
One of the posts that we saw last week was one that mixed the conflict in Ukraine with the riots in France.
The information war is a key part of the military conflict in Ukraine, but misleading and false information about it continues to go viral.
Hi, Yaya Toure here for a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Join me and fellow footballers, Gabriel Zakwani.
Hello.
And Ifan Okuku.
Hi.
As we choose our top 10 from the best of Africa football.
We're not here to play football, but to argue about all things African football.
That's Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcast.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Let's go to France, where the government has banned individuals from buying fireworks. The government's promised also to fully mobilise security forces for the Bastille Day celebrations as it tries to ensure there's no repeat of riots that erupted in the outskirts of Paris 2 weeks ago. Fireworks are a big part of the annual event on the 14th of July, but they were also a favoured weapon for many of the young people who took to the streets in the recent violence. France's Prime Minister, Elizabeth Borne, said efforts were underway to make sure the July celebrations would be safe.
We are fully mobilised to ensure security on the 13th and 14th of July. This involves both preventative action, as you saw this morning when we were able to stop deliveries of pyrotechnical articles, and both the border police and the customs authorities are working hard to prevent these dangerous materials from reaching our country.
The move comes after rioting sparked by last month's killing by police of 17-year-old Nahel in the Paris suburb of Nanterre. I spoke to Alice Dubonnet, a French journalist in Paris. She began by telling me more about the ban.
Every city in France during Bastille Day are doing fireworks, and they will be allowed to do their fireworks. So the institutions are allowed, but it's just me, for example, if I wanted to go into a market and buy fireworks, I'm not allowed to.
Tell me, usually in France, how easy is it to walk into a shop and buy fireworks?
You have to go to special markets, so it's not that easy, but you are allowed as a citizen to do fireworks in your garden if you want. So these people that were planning on doing that won't be able to do it.
And Bastille Day, just to remind us, how much of a significant event is this in terms of France's annual calendar? How much of a big deal is Bastille Day to those of us who don't know?
Well, it is a big deal. It's actually a real celebration. And the main thing of Bastille Day is the fireworks at night. Everybody goes at the city hall or watching the fireworks. So the whole day is planned around these fireworks.
The Prime Minister, the Premier, has talked about a very large-scale deployment, presumably of the police and security forces around Bastille Day to keep people safe.
I think the government is really afraid of seeing something happening on that day, because Bastille Day represents the Republic, you know. So because these rioters were going to burn, for example, city halls, schools, they were burning these things that were representing the Republic. So I think because Bastille Day is a representation of the Republic, they are afraid that it goes again.
Journalist Alice Dubonnet speaking to me from Paris. And as we just heard, during the recent riots in France, many schools were targeted. Nearly 250 were attacked nationwide, 63 of them so badly that they had to close. Our correspondent, John Laurenson, went to Lavière, west of Paris, to see the destruction for himself.
The first thing you notice when you get near the schools, dark stains on the road where the rioters lit dustbin fires to block access to the police and the fire brigade. The second thing, you pick up on the acrid smell of a fire that's burnt itself out. And then you see it, the charred remains of collapsed concrete and mangled metal, a fire-gutted school that looks like a scene from the war in Ukraine. In fact, you'd only know it was a school because of the coloured squares of a hopscotch game marked out on the tarmac in front of it. The mayor, Nicolas Dainville, recounts what happened here.
On avait près d'une centaine de jeunes encagoulés, tout de noir vêtus.
There were almost 100 youths, all dressed in black with balaclavas over their heads. Some of them were carrying iron bars and jerrycans of petrol, highly organized, as if for a military operation. And they attacked what was perhaps the most beautiful thing in the neighborhood.
Il y avait peut-être de plus beau dans le quartier.
Bonjour.
Il arrive, les garçons, ils arrivent, David, ils arrivent.
A father picking up his children at a daycare centre. Most of the kids here are among the 170 whose schools have been burnt down.
Nous n'a rien fait du tout pour que notre école brûle.
We didn't do anything wrong. We didn't deserve to have our school burnt.
C'est pas bien de faire ça. Je comprends pas pourquoi ils ont fait ça.
It's not good to do that. I don't know why they did it. They're mad.
J'avoue, ça me fait de la peine parce que ils sont pas à brûler cette école. Mais tout ça, c'est à cause de la police.
It's painful. They should not have burnt the school. But it's the fault of the police.
Ça va les garçons?
It's a shock for the parents as well.
It's a catastrophe. It makes no sense. I don't understand why they attacked our schools. This is very probably going to hurt their own little brothers and sisters, their own families. It hurts the whole town even, because education is the most important thing, and this is going to impact the lives of all our children.
The parents of the kids who did this should be punished, and the government as well, because they are not up to job. If that police officer did something wrong, he should be judged, but that's no excuse for smashing and burning.
It will take, says the mayor, 3 years to rebuild these schools at a cost of about 20 million euros.
John Laurison reporting from La Verrière in the west of Paris. The information war is a key part of the military conflict in Ukraine, and social media has proved vital for President Zelensky as he defends his country and tries to sustain support from the US and its allies. But misleading and false information about the conflict is continuing to go viral. And some of the most widely shared examples have come from Twitter accounts with a blue tick. That's people, organisations, governments or companies who pay for their content to be promoted to other users. Cheyenne Saderizadeh from BBC Verify gave us some examples of the types of posts.
So one of the posts that we saw last week was one that mixed the conflict in Ukraine with the riots in France. So we saw this widely shared claim, some of it from accounts that subscribe to the Twitter blue feature, saying the French police were firing upon protesters and rioters in the recent French riots with American rifles that had come from Ukraine. And it was basically the picture of two rifles added to the headline, and that was it. So we were curious to find out, first of all, where this article had come from, and try to see whether we could find more information about the claim made in the article. And then when we conducted a proper search on the internet, first of all, we found the same headline and the same picture shared in pro-Kremlin channels on the Telegram messaging app. And then we could not find any actual article with that headline and that picture on the internet. So it turned out that somebody had just basically used an image editing app, most probably, used the image, which, by the way, via reverse searching, we found out was actually from a shooting competition in Moscow in 2012, and just written the headline next to the picture, trying to convince people that this was an actual real article and a legitimate piece of news, and it wasn't. We did contact Twitter. They did not give us any particular response. I mean, there's now an automated email that you receive from Twitter, as said by Mr. Elon Musk, who owns Twitter now, back in March, that every time a member of the press sends Twitter any kind of request, what you get back is a particular emoji that I'm not gonna explain now. So that's exactly the response that we received.
Cheyenne Saderizadeh from BBC Verify. Now, some people believe that great architecture, great buildings, can talk to the people that go by them and go into them. There's an artistic commune, if you will. In Georgia, they have gone a step further. Buildings are singing. An event organised by the National Trust of Georgia, which campaigns to preserve the country's architectural heritage, is giving a voice, literally a voice, to buildings that are in danger of being lost. Ryan Dimitri reports.
If Georgia's collapsing historic buildings could sing, this is the voice they would have, as interpreted by Czech artist Martin Januchak. Imagine the scene, a large three-story building with a wooden facade and lots of windows. But in this particular building, in Tbilisi's historic district of Avlabari, many of the windows are broken. The building is tilting dangerously to one side. The people who used to live here are long gone. On the ground, right next to the building, on a pile of rubble, a dancer is improvising her moves to the sound of a single piano string stretched across the building site. A small crowd of people have gathered to watch. They're looking bemused. Valery Kobahidze lives in the neighborhood.
I don't understand what's happening here. Has some catastrophe befallen the dancer because the house has collapsed? This used to be an old maternity ward, and then it became residential, but people could no longer live in it, so it will be knocked down and everyone will get a new apartment.
The project, titled The Singing Buildings, has been organized by the National Trust of Georgia, which works to preserve historic architecture. And there is a lot of it in Tbilisi, famous for its wooden balconies, residential courtyards, grand double doors at the entrances to historic buildings. The National Trust founder Peter Naismith explains the importance of raising awareness.
The architecture is a reflection of the culture which has grown up around it. If these beautiful, very individually made, imagined pieces of architecture disappear, it has a creeping effect on the whole culture. People start to lose their identity.
The National Trust of Georgia has invited two artists, Martin Janucek from the Czech Republic and Gail Segment from the UK, to collaborate in an experimental style to give the endangered buildings a voice. Martin Janucek does it by finding objects around the buildings and turning them into instruments.
I saw a rest of piano tuning pegs, kind of, which was buried under the rubble. It is an old piano. It has a lot of broken strings, but I attached my own long piano strings, which are 18 meters and 12 meters long, and resonating through this metal fence.
Hi, my name is Gail Sagman. Well, I'm fundamentally a painter.
And what was your role in this on this particular site?
When we came along, I saw this structure and immediately I wanted to paint it black and white. And then when Martin found the section of the piano, it was like, ta-da, we have it.
It's really precious to have these old buildings because they can speak about the history. It's like container of memory.
And unless it's retained, you know, you don't retain the culture. So it's like everything becomes a monoculture.
These performances won't bring back the ruined buildings, but their sound is a reminder of what's been lost and what can still be preserved.
Ryan Dimitri reporting from Tbilisi. Now, it's an open secret that methane emissions from cows contribute significantly to global warming. But now scientists here in the UK have found that adding a chemical extracted from daffodils to cow feed could dramatically reduce the danger. Tom Heap has more.
It's a fact of life. Cows release a fair bit of gas. The government estimates around half the UK's methane emissions comes from cows, and globally that livestock produces around 14% of greenhouse gas emissions. It's one of the reasons there have been calls from climate campaigners to reduce livestock farming. Scientists from the Scottish Rural College have now succeeded in extracting a chemical called hemanthamine from daffodils, and laboratory tests using an artificial cow's stomach have shown it could reduce methane by 30%. Now feeds with a chemical added are being tested on a number of farms across the country to see if it works in animals. If successful, the government says it could make it a legal requirement to use methane-reducing supplements like this on farms in the next few years.
That's Tom Heap. Abby Reader is from the National Farmers Union here in Britain.
As livestock farmers, we're definitely up for looking for different alternatives to help reduce methane emissions. We need to make sure it is safe for them to eat. We need to make sure it's economical. We need to make sure it actually does what it says it's going to do and reduce that methane. And you need to make sure it doesn't affect the performance of the cow either.
Abby Reader. Now, have a listen to this. If you recognise that, then you know who I am about to talk about, which makes you a real fan already. That was the song Dynamite from the K-pop pioneers BTS, originally from South Korea. Their memoir is one of the most anticipated books of the year. It's been released to coincide with their 10th anniversary, yes, 10 years, as a group, and it lets fans in behind the scenes of making their biggest hits. I asked the BBC's Stephanie Prentice if the book was causing a stir.
That song we just heard, and might have been dancing to even, that was their first hit fully recorded in English, and that's the one that really made them world famous. It got them their first billion views on YouTube, now actually sits at around 1.7 billion. That gives you a small sense of just how big BTS are. So this book, you mentioned, it's called Beyond the Story. It's a chronological history of the band from when they started up to the present day. Now, this is a band with some of the most devoted fans in the business. They're known as ARMY. They've been waiting for this book. They've been discussing it online. And at one shop in Seoul, fans were seen queuing in the rain to be some of the first to even get their hands on a copy. Now, let's have a quick listen to some of them.
If I say from 1 to 10 scale, then it's about a million times excited. I'm purposely here on a holiday to get this book.
I came here since 9 a.m. and finally I get this book.
Thank you for saving me when I needed you. That's all. I wish I could say more, but I'm going to cry now.
So, as you could hear there, this is a band that inspires an ardent fan base. And the initial print run on this book was 1 million copies.
OK, big numbers, staggering numbers. What have we learned from the book?
In a way, this book is filling a gap for fans because the group were on hiatus. Two of them were actually doing active military service in South Korea. But this hints at their future plans. It includes some more solo work from some of them. It delves into tough times they've had and how around 2018 they were discussing breaking up. They were very stressed out. One quote actually says they were working on a record called Love Yourself, but they say they couldn't love themselves. It also addresses quite fun little bits of gossip in their history, including what became quite a famous fight between two members over dumplings. Now, this culminated in them not speaking for days. In the book, they say they were hungry and they were overtired. I mean, we've all been there. And they ended up going for a drink and they talked it out.
Stephanie Prentice, big BTS fan. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. As always, if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. That's it from me. Goodbye.